In fact, before I knew that Dr. Spencer was going to be on this evening, I had a question for you concerning the environmental situation, kind of an overall question that I'm going to ask in open lines whenever we get to that, and we will. But this was way, way too good an opportunity to pass up. So at the last moment, Dr. Spencer became available, and we grabbed him. Now, George, thank you for a nice night to fill in. Hope you enjoy the time off, and good evening, everybody. Roy Spencer, Dr. Spencer, is a principal research scientist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. He has been senior scientist for climate studies at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. He directs research into the development and application of satellites' passive microwave remote sensing techniques for measuring global temperature, water vapor, and precipitation. Dr. Spencer is the recipient of NASA's Medal for Exceptional Scientific Achievement and the American Meteorological Society's Special Award for his satellite-based temperature monitoring work. He is the author of numerous scientific articles that have appeared in Science, Nature, Journal of Climate, Monthly Weather Review, Journal of Atmospheric and Oceanic Technology, Journal of Climate and Applied Meteorology, Remote Sensing Reviews, Advances in Space Research, and Climate Change. Dr. Spencer received his PhD in meteorology from the University of Wisconsin in 1981. In a moment, you will meet Dr. Spencer. I've got a really nice long article here on the dust up that Dr. Hansen just had, and you all have heard about with Dr. Hansen, who's been warning about global warming now for in an alarming way for some time, not much to the displeasure, I might add, of NASA. And so what an opportunity to have Dr. Spencer here. Welcome, Doctor.
Hey, Art, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And I'm really appreciative of this opportunity to have you on. You at one time worked for NASA, correct?
Yes, I've been working with NASA either as a contractor or as a NASA employee for the last 20 years. 14 of those years were as a NASA employee, and then 4 years ago, I resigned from NASA and took a position at the local university here, but I still do all the same work that I used to do when I was a NASA employee.
I'm sure you've followed very closely the problems Dr. Hansen has had recently. Since you did work for NASA, perhaps you can sympathize with what he's been through, or how do you?
Well, to some extent, but also I sympathize with NASA's side of this whole thing. You see, federal employees are under quite a few rules that you have to abide by, and in fact, those rules are one of the reasons that I resigned from NASA.
Does that include talking to people like me?
You're allowed to, but you're supposed to go through channels, through management chain, and make public affairs office aware of what you're doing and
Right.
get the material cleared, which is what
Right.
I always had to do, especially if you're testifying for Congress, which Jim and I have both done, Jim Hansen and me.
Right. Okay. Understandable. But if you have made requests and they've not been fully granted or in a way that satisfies you and you're not able to speak out and the issue is so damn big, I mean, how do you weigh that out?
Well, I think, okay, on Jim's side, I would say that if I were in his position and believed as he does, I probably would have done exactly what he's doing. When I worked for NASA, and it's this, the rules are still the same now, you are allowed to speak authoritatively as a NASA employee on the science that you study. If you have opinions related to what the policy should be,
Right.
you have to make it very clear that you're saying those things as a private citizen and not as an expert.
And you take your chances when you do that anyway, I'm sure.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, for a lot of years, Jim Hansen was able to basically not worry too much about NASA rules, because the things he was saying were in line with what NASA wanted to hear or have told to Congress anyway. I mean, let's face it, organizations like NASA and NOAA depend on Congress for a large part of their funding through these climate change appropriations bills, where they get a lot of money to build instruments, put them into space, study what's going on in the climate. In other words, you know, there's a whole machinery going on in the federal government that's related to climate change.
Got it.
And the more you can make it look like these are important things to be done, the more money you can get and the bigger your program grows. So for a lot of years, Jim Hansen basically was singing the tune that NASA wanted him to sing anyway, even though they knew that he was sort of going off and sometimes ignoring, I think, you know, the channels that he was supposed to go through. Now, it could be that what's happened lately is it may well have been, and I don't know, it may well have been that the administration came in and said, hey, we want you to start we want you to start forcing Jim to abide by these rules, which have always been in place. but to him, it feels like pressure, because now all of a sudden he's being asked to abide by rules that in the past you could just sort of, you know, get by with without worrying too much about them. But like I said, if I believed as Jim does, you know, that it's as serious of a problem as he thinks global warming is, and I don't think it is, and he believes that there are certain policy solutions that we can implement to fix the problem, which I don't think there are. But I'm saying, if I was in his position, I might well have done exactly what he's done. He's got a lot of political power. I mean, he's worked in this area since the 60s, or worked for NASA since, I think, the late 60s. He's Mr. Climate Change as far as NASA's concerned. He's a great scientist. And like I said, if I was in his shoes, I may well have done exactly the same thing he did.
Well, there's a lot in what you just said to explore. It's my understanding that some years ago, as a result of speaking out, there was some wrath that came down in the form of cut budgets in his department, and so he went through a pretty rough period because of that earlier, didn't he?
I had never heard that, so that would be news to me.
I see. All right, let's define what it is Dr. Hansen believes, and then the difference in what you believe.
Okay, basically, what Jim believes, I mean, I hate to speak for him, but I always try to be able to present the other side as well as I can. I think basically what Jim Hansen believes is that the current warm period we're in, the warming that we've seen in the last 100 years, can largely be explained, especially, let's say, since the 1940s, through both aerosols that have been produced by mankind through pollution, which causes a cooling, and then now we don't have so much aerosols anymore, but we have more and more carbon dioxide, which causes warming. And Jim has put together a quantitative explanation for how the global temperature has changed in the last however many decades, that is based mostly on mankind. I think it is one possible explanation. I think that he's ignoring other possible explanations, which includes a combination of natural influences and mankind.
Okay, well, now, that's got to be possible, doesn't it, Doctor? In other words,
in fact, I'm probably not phrasing this well enough. He would probably object and say he does have natural influences in there, and he does. What I'm saying is he thinks that the warming effect of extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, he thinks that that is a larger effect than I think it is on global temperatures and on global climate.
Okay, but you would agree that he does believe that there are natural cycles. It's all very well documented with ice cores and everything.
Yes, yeah, he believes there's natural cycles. He just thinks that this current really warm period we're in right now, let's say the warming in the last 30 years, can all be explained by mankind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, in my view, until we understand all the natural cycles, we really can't say how much is due to mankind. But I'm willing to admit that, you know, at least I would guess probably half of it is due to mankind.
Oh, well, that's that's still very significant. I mean, if you take a natural cycle that might go to some point that we can't define right now, and then you enhance it by half with the addition of mankind, I mean, that's 50% of the process. So you've got, if that's what you believe.
I'm willing to admit that there's a good chance that mankind is a significant part of the warmth that we're experiencing right now. The big question is, well, there's a number of big questions.
Oh, there sure are.
So what? How much is it going to warm in the future? What are we going to be using for fuels in 30 or 40 years with technological process? And even, or progress, but even if we don't have any technological progress that can get us past fossil fuels in the next 50 years, what can we do about it anyway? If you get into the policy and look at alternative fuels and the direction humanity is going, especially to developing parts of the world like India and China, I just don't see any way to keep from having this upward trend in increasing carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere.
I'm afraid I'm with you. I've been to China and took the tour into Shenzhen and then on up into Canton, and this was years ago, Doctor, and it scared the hell out of me. I passed 40 miles of factories on both sides of the road. I mean, it was unbelievable, and that was years ago. So,
yeah, well, they're going through their industrial revolution that, you know, we went through 100 years ago.
That's right.
It's very messy early on because countries that go through this process aren't that concerned about pollution early on. And then as they build wealth, they can start to afford to, you know, clean up after themselves more, which we've been doing for quite a while now. And also now, you know, to the extent that we can transfer technology, the things that we've learned, to the developing countries so that they can do things more cleanly than we did 100 years ago, that's a big benefit too. And that's one of the things I think that is part of Bush's plan, is it's sort of technology-based.
I had an opportunity to go to Bangkok once as well. And there, about 40% of the policemen who direct traffic in the street have lung disease.
Have what?
Lung disease.
Yeah, uh-huh.
About 40% or better. That's incredible. And
yeah,
so, you know, many of these countries that you're talking about really are going to contribute very, very heavily. And as you point out, we've become a little better. I mean, California's a little cleaner. Some of our lakes and our water is cleaned up a little bit, and things are generally, I would say, admittedly, better here. But then you've got Eastern Europe, you've got all of Asia, you've got all these emerging technological nations. And so I guess what we all want to know is, if you take that natural cycle and then you're 50% of man's hand, and you look at the possibilities, no, the probabilities, with climate modeling or whatever, do you and Dr. Hansen disagree on the probable outcome, the effects for mankind, if we continue on the same path, which obviously you believe we will?
I think he believes that the climate system is more sensitive to extra CO2 than I believe it is, probably by, I'm guessing, but let's say maybe at least a factor of two. And of course, then you've got people who think that there are these tipping points where, you know, the system is really sensitive beyond some point and it warms uncontrollably. I basically do not believe in that theory. But then, you know, this is an area of science that we don't have perfect knowledge of. So it's almost like anything is possible.
You're talking about a kind of a feedback loop.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. It's feedback, because the direct warming from doubling of the CO2, and we will reach a point of doubled CO2 sometime late in this century. That is compared to what the CO2 concentration was in the atmosphere, let's say, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, that's a big change for our atmosphere. Doubling of anything is a big, big change.
Well, except that 2 times 0 is still zero. So it does make a difference how much there is, and there's very little carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. What my point was going to be is that when you double the CO2, we can compute that the amount of warming that results in is only about 1 degree Fahrenheit. I mean, it would be fine to live with. In fact, you know, history has shown us that warmer is better for humanity. The question is how much it's going to warm, and that's where we get into the feedbacks that you were talking about, and that's where all the debate is in the feedbacks. Will the climate system respond in such a way that it amplifies that warming from the extra CO2, or where it sort of mitigates the warming? And that's where there's a lot of uncertainty, and that's where all the arguments are.
All right. Let's look at examples then. One of the examples of feedback that they give is if you look at the North Pole right now and you look at it 40 years ago, it's frightening. I mean, a lot of it's already gone, and they're now the Navy's plotting ways to navigate what's, you know, going to be an ocean after the ice is all gone. Now, the ice is sort of white and sort of reflects sunlight, right? So as the ice melts, it's my understanding that the water, which is then dark, absorbs heat, and the white doesn't reflect it anymore, and so more melts and more and more and more. Is that the feedback kind of thing we're talking about?
That's one of the positive feedbacks that's hypothesized to amplify the warming. Yes, that's the ice albedo feedback, and it operates exactly the way you said it.
Yes. Is it likely to be correct?
Well, there's no doubt there is a positive feedback. The question is, why has it warmed up there? You see, there's in the climate system, you've got it's like a whole bunch of weights on springs. You've got fluctuations up and down, back and forth, and they're all interacting in complicated nonlinear ways, but they're still constrained like a weight on a spring. You know, it will only go so far down, and then it pops back up, and then it pops up higher than its equilibrium position, and then it falls back down.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is, you know, one of the theories is that the current warmth we're in is at least, you know, half due to natural cycles. For instance, if you look at how the ice in the Arctic has changed in the last 40 years, it tracks almost perfectly a large planetary scale northern hemispheric natural circulation shift that has also changed in the last 40 years that happens with or without mankind. It's like the whole hurricane thing in the Atlantic. It wasn't that all of a sudden there was a bunch of hurricanes on the earth last year. It was about a normal year. It just is there were hardly, you know, there were very few in the Pacific, and we had a whole bunch in the Atlantic. It's a regional shift that we know happens. It's been warned about for 20 years. So again, we're getting back to this issue is how much of what we've seen is due to natural cycles versus mankind.
All right. So, Doctor, if I were to ask you why the temperature at the North Pole and even Alaska, for example, is disproportionately increasing compared to a lot of the rest of the world, your answer would be a natural cycle.
Well, I would say that we really don't know. At this point, we really don't know how much of it's due to mankind versus natural cycles. Now, I agree that all this science stuff is interesting.
No. What I was asking about was the fact that it was so disproportionately higher there than it is, rising more than it is elsewhere.
Well, I would be surprised if it was equal everywhere. In fact, if it was equal everywhere, I guess that would look to me more like global warming, where it's more uniform everywhere, whereas if it's more regional, you think of natural cycles, because, you know, natural cycles typically, you know, they cause droughts one place and heat waves another place. You know, you expect to see quite a bit of variability geographically. So to me, that doesn't tell me anything really about whether it's natural or man-made, just to say that it's so much more at the pole. But I guess you're thinking about the feedback we were talking about, right?
Well, to some degree, but I mean, the fact that it is increasing at a faster rate there than, for example, here, if we have 1 degree,
yes,
they have, what, 3 or 4?
Definitely warmed more towards the pole. Yes, it has.
Well, how come?
Well, we don't know. Some people think they know. I guess someday I've had this idea rolling around in my head. I think someday I'm gonna make Jim Hansen a bet, like maybe $1,000.
Once again, Dr. Ray Spencer, Doctor, how big a wager would you make that, and what would be the terms if you could set it up?
Well, the thing I'd been kicking around in my head is, a bet of $1,000 on whether the year 2015 is warmer or colder than the year 2005 was.
Huh.
Can't go too far out in the future because, you know, Jim's getting close to retirement, and, you know, I'm not as close as he is, but it won't be that much longer, you know.
Uh-huh. So you're looking to enrich your retirement a little bit.
Oh, well, this is more of a, this is more just to, you know, point out that we can, we scientists can predict all we want, but we really don't lose anything if we're wrong, you know.
Well, yeah, but we do. Now,
that's true.
Matt from Phoenix, I get these computer messages as we go along, and really does ask a good question. Why isn't it possible to construct some kind of lab test, some kind of a smaller but on-scale environment to test the effects of CO2 emissions on our environment? Or is there just nothing that's close enough?
Nothing that's close enough. There's nowhere near. In fact, I looked at a lab apparatus just to look at the infrared absorption by carbon dioxide, just to show, you know, just to actually measure how much infrared absorption, that's, you know, that's what a greenhouse gas does, is it absorbs infrared or heat radiation.
Right.
And basically, the effect you're looking for can't be measured really in the laboratory. You have to have a distance, like through the depth of the atmosphere, in order to actually observe what's going on. It's a very complex process. It can only be, it's the Earth is our only laboratory for this. You know, there's really nothing you can do in the lab to address this, and it's too bad. You know, it's a one of a kind of experiment that we're involved in now, and we don't have complete control over it, and that's one reason why there's so many uncertainties.
Well, we were once going to build a big collider down in Texas. We didn't build it, but even if we built something gigantic that would try and produce...
there's nothing you can do. It's I know it's hard to believe. It seems like there's something you could do. All of the things involved, like the effect of water... I mean, the effects of water, both in terms of how it warms the climate and cools the climate,
yes,
is just so profound. And that means rain systems, and in order to build rain systems, they have to extend up through miles of the atmosphere. Otherwise, they don't occur. You know, you just can't, you can't do it on a smaller scale.
Well, I know you worked in the oceanic area a little bit, and so while we're on the subject of ocean currents, you know, there is this theory, actually it's a bit more than a theory now, that this current, which warms Europe or keeps Europe relatively temperate, is beginning to splinter and slow up. Now, again, this could, of course, be a natural cycle or something, but if it were to stop, then I guess Europe would be about like Labrador. Is that accurate or inaccurate?
Well... you know, if the current were to stop, yeah, there would be huge changes. I'm one of the people that believes that that's simply not possible, partly because the fluid of the atmosphere and ocean is a gigantic heat engine, and one of the functions of this heat engine is to take excess energy that's built up in the tropics from the extra sunlight in the tropics and transport it to the poles. And as long as the Earth keeps turning, and as long as the tropics, you know, keep getting more sunlight than the poles, I just don't see any way to stop that. Now, that's not to say that there can't be changes in all of these currents, you know, all of the little smaller structures that are occurring, you know, like the Labrador current.
Right.
You know, there's all these different currents that are part of the ocean circulation. And those can meander and change on all kinds of timescales, weeks, months, years, even decades.
To what degree?
So it's entirely possible to have something drastic happen.
Okay.
But it's awfully hard to predict.
to what degree does your science with the atmosphere come together with the study of the ocean and those currents? In other words, are the two intimately related or remotely related?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I would say more remotely related than intimately related. The big difference between atmosphere and ocean is because the ocean has so much mass and the whole thing's a fluid, it has a huge amount of memory. In other words, whatever heat it has in it, if it has some excess heat, it takes a long time to get rid of it. And if it's a little cooler than normal, it takes a long time to warm it up because the depth of the ocean stores a huge amount of heat. The depth of the atmosphere stores very little heat. So what the ocean does, it does on very long time scales, decades or centuries, whereas the atmosphere adjusts in a matter of days.
Uh-huh. Well, we all watched this last hurricane season with some horror. Some amazing things happened, actually, during that hurricane season, and I guess we're about to get into another one. But boy, oh boy, oh boy, I watched some of those hurricanes go from, you know, tropical storms to Category 5 hurricanes in just like, I don't know, a couple of days or, 2 days, I think, I saw one.
Well, that's always happened. You know, they're called rapid deepening cycles. And, you know, the whole time I've been in this business, you know, 20 years or so, 25 years, that's been happening. I think that one of the things that's lost about this hurricane season is the fact that the National Hurricane Center directors have been warning year after year.
It's true.
For about 15 or 20 years now that we were in a lull and that we're building up the coastlines. People keep moving to the coast. We, you know, keep building infrastructure there. And one of these days, it's all going to change, and these hurricanes are going to come back. I don't think anybody could have predicted how dramatically they came back last year.
Is there any way to predict how long the cycle of back, as you put it, will remain?
All they can tell is, like, just from this past century, we really only have statistics for, let's say, the last 100 years. So there's, like, two cycles in there of hurricane activity, two at the most. That are like 25, 35 years long. So all they can do is just sort of take a guess that, you know, there's probably this 20 to 40 year cycle and we're in the upswing of it now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have higher than normal activity. That doesn't mean we couldn't have a year with below normal activity, just that, you know, on average, year after year, we should be above normal now for quite a few years.
Well, if you were in the Senate, in front of the Senate, testifying, and they were to ask you about the advisability of rebuilding New Orleans at the same location and not getting the levees past the protection point where they failed in this last large hurricane, and you were to speak to them from a scientific point of view, what would you tell them?
You're saying if they just went ahead and rebuilt and just repaired the levees and kept the levees at the same height?
Yes, it's more or less my understanding that that's exactly the situation. And, of course, they're going to be bulldozing and rebuilding the Ninth Ward and, you know, most of the city. They're going to just rebuild it, but it's not protected to a point past which it already failed.
I would say that if they didn't change the levee system at all, that they may well be safe for another 20 or 30 years. Or it may be it gets destroyed again in another 1 or 2 years. You don't know. But eventually it's going to happen again. But they've known for years that this was a possibility. In fact, just less than a year before this all happened, the Times-Picayune newspaper down there ran a series of articles which were almost like foretelling of the future. Because all the things that they warned about, and they talked to all the experts and weather and how much New Orleans has sunk, and hurricane cycles and stuff, and the stuff they laid out in that series of newspaper articles, you know, of what could happen, you know, sounded like fear-mongering, and it's like a lot of it happened.
Turned out to be quite prophetic, you know.
Yeah.
Back now to our climate. Now, the difference between yourself and Dr. Hansen, clearly one of the differences is that you think there's not really a whole hell of a lot we can do about it.
Right. On the policy side, I don't think there's much that we can do about it in the next 20 to 30 years.
All right. Exactly, Doctor. What is that going to mean if you're right, and what will it mean if Dr. Hansen's right?
What will it mean?
Yes, sir. In other words, in another 20 or 30 years, in what different way, for example, will we be living if you're right, and how differently might we be living if Dr. Hansen's correct?
Okay, well, if I'm right, I think we're going to see some modest warming in the coming decades, and I would hate to say anything beyond a few decades because I don't think we know what energy source we're going to be using in 30 years. But I would predict modest warming enough that we could, little enough to where mankind is basically going to be able to adapt to it, although there will be negative effects in some areas, you know, a net negative effect in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
If Jim Hansen's right, it's going to just keep warming, and, you know, in another 50 or 60 years, we're going to have some serious problems coping with the change in climate, with the rising sea levels. You know, it's going to get to the point where some man-made structures along the coasts, the low-lying areas, will have to be abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is something that's going to be occurring, even if it does happen, over a long period of time.
But not really. I mean, you know, when you're talking about, say, I don't know, 40 or 50 years, that seems like a lot of time to a mortal man, because we don't last that long. But in the wider sort of whole Earth-type picture, I mean, you think of things happening in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of years.
Oh, yeah, there's no question that if this were to happen, if this does happen, if Jim Hansen is right, it is happening faster than the Earth has ever, let's say the Earth has ever seen it before. I'm pretty skeptical of what we know has happened in the past. I think we have a hard enough time trying to figure out how the heck the climate system works in the last 100 years, let alone figuring out what happened 10,000 years ago based on sediments in some remote part of the Earth.
All right, well, that brings on another question. How good are ice cores in telling us what has happened in the past?
I don't trust them. I think there's too many assumptions built into all that, but, you know, you can get an ice core expert on here that'll, you know, tell you a totally different story, and I'm not an ice core expert, so I'm probably not a good one to ask.
I suppose they would say it's as good as fingerprints or something.
Yeah, probably. I mean, everyone likes to think that their area of science is, you know, pretty nailed down.
Well, they sure do. They sure do. We'll talk about that, too. But why do you think ice cores don't tell the detailed story that the experts in that field believe?
I think it's possible that when you get down to the through the lower layers of the ice, where these layers that they're measuring become very thin, I think it starts blurring the distinction between what they think is annual layers, things laid down by season, versus individual storms,
right,
which would really reduce the time scale of the events they find down there. So that's what has me skeptical.
Well, if they look back, I guess, in ice cores in certain places, they can see when something apparently hit the Earth, an asteroid, and probably wiped out the dinosaurs, some scientists or most.
Well, but that's all indirect dating, too. I think the only thing we have good dates for is known volcanic eruptions in specific years. You know, let's say a volcano back in 1532 or something, when we have historical records of what happened. Otherwise, all you're doing is replacing one dating technique with another, you know. So the whole 65 million year thing, I don't trust a whole lot either.
Uh-huh. Okay. How good are our current satellites in terms of helping us try and decide who's right about this climate thing? How much, I guess they're of large assistance, right?
Well, of course, that's the area that I've worked in for the last 15 years. John Christie and I did the first global temperature monitoring with the satellites. But
yes,
that only goes back to 1979, so it's only like 26, 27 years, which is pretty short for a climate timescale.
Oh, yes.
It doesn't help too much. What satellites really help us do, and this is with a bunch of different satellite instruments, is to understand processes on a global basis, because it's the only way we can get truly global measurements. And to understand the Earth, you really got to have global measurements. Satellites are really the only way to do it, so they provide some really unique measurements. They can't do what you can do from the ground, they can't provide the detail that you can get from a weather balloon, but at least you got the measurements everywhere on the Earth. So they really help us improve our understanding of how the climate system works. I don't think they're that good at telling us how much it's warmed or not, partly because it's only 26 years. And as it is, you know, what the satellites are telling us now is roughly consistent with the surface thermometers. That's a finding that's going to come out in the coming few months that you'll be hearing about in the news when it comes out.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of information not exactly public yet.
Right, right. Yeah, it's you know, that for a long time there's been this issue that the satellites have supposedly disagreed with the satellite or with the surface thermometer data.
Yes.
And the conclusion from a panel of people that are working on this, and I can't say too much, is basically going to back off on that quite a bit and say that
it is consistent.
Yeah, well, to within, you know, our ability to measure these things. You know, there's errors in every kind of measurement, whether it's the surface thermometers or satellite data. So within our ability to measure these things, you know, they're probably not inconsistent.
What was the argument, Doctor, of those who were arguing that there was an inconsistency between the two? What were they trying to suggest?
Okay, the argument was that the way we understand the atmosphere to work on monthly or longer time scales over big areas, if the surface warms, the troposphere, the lowest part of the atmosphere, let's say the bottom 10 kilometers, should warm at least that much. In other words, the warming gets amplified with height in the atmosphere.
Right.
And what we were seeing was the opposite. If we took the thermometer data and the satellite data at face value, it looked like the satellite was warming much less than the thermometer data. We were the only ones for a long time, John and I, that did this global temperature monitoring. It was a kind of thing that was too important for only to have only one group work on it.
Sure.
So there's a group of researchers out in California that we know very well that have also worked on it. And in the last 8 years or so, they've found two errors in how we did adjustments on the satellite data.
Mm-hmm.
And we've corrected for those errors. They've come up with their corrections. We both get answers that aren't too terribly different from each other and sufficiently close to what the thermometers get, to where you really can't say that, you know, there's any kind of stark disagreement between them that would suggest that we really don't understand the theory,
right,
of how the warming at the surface should be amplified with height. But I was never one to buy into that being a huge discrepancy in our knowledge anyway. It was more people that were really into the, you know, finding whatever argument they could against global warming theory kind of latched on to the satellite data. Oh,
yes, I've heard and had the argument made here on the air. So it is kind of big news that there is not really a discrepancy that's going to sort of rip away the underpinnings of one argument, yes?
Well, I'm not going to say what the specific conclusion is, and I don't want to go any farther.
You said enough.
I'm just saying that it's not going to be, it's not going to be that, oh, we still have this huge discrepancy. It's not going to be like that. It's going to have a more resolved flavor to it when it all finally comes out.
Yes. Okay. We're going to break here at the top of the hour, and I'd like to hold you over just a little bit if I could. I'm getting a lot of really good information here, so hang tight.